Today I'm going to talk about the new Jumanji guidance, my PhD project, so involving one-on-one experiments. Today the story I would like to tell is basically to summarize what we have learned from the Fermilab experiment, and since the publication of the Fermilab final result last year, I've been trying to kind of exchange some ideas within the community to try to figure out what we can do in the next step. So there's going to be some ideas about the next generation experiment ideas that I will share with you today. So this is part of the story. We start basically from this G factor. So very simple, this is the gyromagnetic ratio, which relates a particle's magnetic moment to its spin. So we know if the animated particle, which has a magnetic moment, and if you put this particle in the magnetic field, and if the moment is not aligned with the field, it's going to process. This magnetic momentum comes intrinsically from its spin, and the G factor relates its spin to the moment. From the Dirac equation, we know that these G factors should be exactly two for the elementary fermions, like electron, muon, and tau. So this is direct muon interaction in the electric magnetic field, so this tri-level coupling. But later on, we know this higher order effect we call sort of the virtual particles, so they appear and disappear. For example, muon could emit one particle, virtual particle, and it can get absorbed by the muon later. So these virtual particles force this G factor, affects this G factor, and makes it deviated from the two. Any kind of these virtual particles could be within the standard model of the particle physics or any new physics particles that is unknown force. So this is the basic picture that we are trying to measure the G factor and use it as a probe to any new physics beyond the standard model. This G factor was firstly measured in 1948. At that time, it was for the G factor for the electron, and we do find out there's a slight deviation of this G factor from two. You see, it's a tiny deviation, but in kind of a very precise level. So people start to think about any reasons for this deviation from two. And the Schrödinger was the one firstly calculated this higher order QED effect. So in the true level, sorry, in the first loop level, when there's a single virtual photon emit and be observed by the muon. So this was the first order effect, which gives G slightly above two for electron. And you can see it can be calculated very precisely, so half over two pi. And it's independent of the lepton mass, so it's the same for electron, muon, and tau. Nowadays, we know this is a great triumph. So it has been back to then in the history, it was a milestone or a critical step in the development of the QED. You can see this was also engraved on the gravestone of Schrödinger. And later on, we know as the both experiment and the theory, especially the establishment of the standard model, we know there are more interactions, not only QED, but also the other interactions. So we define this magnetic anomaly. So this is G minus two. The reason is that we basically factor out the constant two that we know and focus on these small deviations. And not only QED, but also now we know electric weak and more complicated QCD processes, such as the heavy hadronic vacuum polarization and hadronic lyophilization. All these interactions will contribute to the this G minus two value. So now we know in the standard model it contributes from, I mean, all the QED, electrolyte, and QCD contributes to the standard model. And another point I want to highlight here is that you see that this G minus two can be very precisely calculated from each finite diagrams. So this value is not model dependent, as some of the physics observable, you see, they can also be measured very precisely. For example, the radius of the proton, but somehow they could be model dependent. In this case, each very precise standard model Feynman diagrams we can calculate, well, in principle analytically, or in the other ways like the perturbative theory to calculate its contribution to the standard model. So that we can compare this one to the theory predictions to the experimental measurement and try to find the deviation. This has been evolving since 1957, when there was first the G minus two measurement for muon. Actually, Liverpool was one of the locations contribute to that, and the precision has been up down to probably 0.1 parts per million, so 10 times 10 to the minus 6. And on the other hand, in parallel, theory also progresses. So this is kind of an interaction, you know. Sometimes theory performs better than the experiment, so that it triggers a higher precision measurement. And the feedback from the measurement in a very high precision also motivates theory to include more precise calculations. So this is the G minus two, and the principle is simple. You know, if the standard model is correctly predicted and if the theory match the experiment, then it can help to rule out a lot of fake experimental theory models. But if the standard model is correctly incorrectly predicted, then we don't agree with it, then this is a hint of a new physics. So it opens a lot of possibilities for building up theory models. Finally, why we are interested in the G minus of the muon, not, for example, electron, because as I say, both electron and muons can be measured and calculated to very high precision. But the thing is, the sensitivity to the new physics scale is proportional to the one of the sorry the mass ratio square. So this mass could be electron or could be muon, and we know this muon is about 200 times heavier than the electron. So the sensitivity to the new physics particles is about 40,000 for the muon, higher than the electron. This makes muon a better probe for the new phase, even if the electron G minus two can be measured even more precisely. You see, I think it was okay, this could be slightly outdated citation, but I think it was to 2020 or so. And electron G minus two was measured again at Harvard to a very high precision to ppb to pointed to 4 ppb level. I was gonna say this is one of the most precisely measured particle physics observables, but I just checked a few hours ago with ChatGPT, and they told me that it is the most precise physics observable. So that's it. Electron G minus two is measured very precisely, and if you see it, the muon G minus two is less precise, but still, it's only like 2,000 times less precise than the electron dimension, but the mass factor here is 40,000. So still, muon dimension beats electron as a better probe to the new physics particles. And even any difference between the current experiment and theory, so the zeta mu, if we take value of 2.5 10 to minus 9, this will correspond to a new physics probe scale up to 100 TeV. So this is a quite wide range, even beyond the current collider limits, which is roughly, let's say, a few TeV for the LHC. So this is a way that we use the precise measurement to probe a higher, even a higher energy scale for the new particle physics. So these are some examples of these new physics models and their corresponding mass range. Actually, I think this slide, some of these values should be updated because after the final publication of the firm measurements, I think some range here should be again be updated or even ruled out. But this is just a few illustrations to show that by using the new measurements tool, we do have a lot of the theory models that can be tested. So this is the basic principle, and I'll use a few slides just to introduce the progression of the theory and the experimental results. The story started from, let's say, Brookhaven, after Brookhaven Gemini's results in 2021, when there was a difference between the experiment and the theory. At that time, let's say, it was about a 3 or 4 sigma. It was tempting, so that's why people started to think about the next experiment, possibly at Fermilab. And you see, at that time, theory also had been very nicely converging, although this was only, let's say, one approach at that time, but there are different groups providing different results. And that converges in 2020 when the theory initiative provided a benchmark for, let's say, G-minus official G-minus theory prediction. Then we know, starting from 2021, Fermilab has provided 3 times publicating 3 results. We call round 1, round 3, and 4, 5, 6, accumulating at the 2025, the Fermilab results up to 0.1 ppm precision. You see, this error bar has been really greatly reduced, and all these different results are quite consistent with each other. On the other hand, there's a significant progress on the theory, but the situation is a bit messy. So one approach we call a data-driven approach for calculating hydronic vacuum polarization. There are several data. I will explain why there are several these different approaches from different let's say colliders. But you see, for example, at that time, the Chloe and the Barr shows kind of some tensions previously. That was the dominant issue that theorists was trying to understand. But later on, after, I think right after Fermilab Round 1 publication, since 2021, there were two things that actually shaped the confidence of the theory landscape. One is we call the CMD3, the other is the BMW 20. So this BMW collaboration in a blue color, this was the first largest calculation that whose precision matches the green colored approach. So that was, I think the publication from the Nature was right after, I think the same day or one day right after the Round 1 publication from Fermilab. So that story made a kind of a worldwide news. And the CMD3 was actually in 2023. So we call so kind of a February surprise because this was done by experimentalists from the CMD3 collider, spectroscopy in a collider at Novosibirsk. So Fyodor was actually the author who made this result. So you see, this result is very different from all the previous green-colored dots. So it was really a big surprise to the community. And I still remember, so this was a photo taken around that time because Fyodor joined the Liverpool right after he finished his CMP3 analysis. So he joined Liverpool in our team in, I think, January 2023 or somewhere. So that was the first time when he joined and we had the launch in Liverpool. So this one was him. And here, this one was my boss, Graziano. He was smiling, but I guess he was a bit frustrated because he used to be the author or the main analyzer for the Chloe analysis. And this Chloe was one of the points that is very far away from the experiment and also CNBC. And he was also the spokesperson of the Fermilab analysis at that time. So basically, he contributed to this point and this point, and they are quite different. So yeah, that was the story at the time. Later on, up to today, there has been major progress, not only the BMW, but also other Lattice groups who also provide a comparable precision using the Lattice QCD vector. So that made the Theory Initiative to publicate an updated result in 2025. So this result is purely from the Lattice approach. So all the blue dots we have and completely ignores the green data-driven results. One reason is apparently because people do not know how to deal with the CMP3, how to combine. It's basically impossible to combine these CMP3 points with all the other previous results. So this is still under discussion, and to be honest, the theoristic needs to understand what's going on, why they caused this difference before they can converge a better green point from this data-driven approach. So I'll use a few slides very quickly to introduce these two approaches in the theory. Oh, of course, then actually after, I mean, in recent few months, there are also updated results from the Bavard and also the BMW collaboration. So you see these points are now there, and there's not a very good agreement between all these two approaches. So this data-driven approach has been a long-standing recipe. The point is, in order to calculate especially the QCD contribution to the G-2, which means the module fold zone creates the hadronic bubble before it gets observed by the mirror again. To calculate this hadronic bubble, one way is to use the optical theorem. So the imaginary part is proportional to a cross-section. This can be illustrated simply if we do, kind of look at this bubble, and if we cut this bubble in the middle, this becomes a virtual photon goes to, let's say, pi plus pi minus or other hadrons. So this could be on the right-hand side as well. And if we put this diagram another two outer legs of E plus E minus, this could be, exactly what we have tried to measure in the collider. So E plus minus, so pi pi, or the other hadronic processes. So that's the relation. And we can further relate these cross-section by the dispersion theory so that the G-2 in a hadronic contribution can be related directly to the experimental measurement of all the cross sections of E plus E minus the hydrogens. So that's why actually the theorists, when they calculate the G minus two, they will need experimental inputs. And this is particularly important for QCD because in the other contributions, such as QED, it's possible to use analytical way to calculate a very high precision. But in a QCD, especially at the low energy level, the perturbative theory cannot be used. So this was the best way, we call data-driven approach, to plug in experiment data to help with calculating the theory contribution in hadron section. And that's why, in the low energy range, we see a different contributions from all the channels. And E plus E minus 2 pi pi was the dominant one. You see the contribution here. This was the dominant one. And as you know, there are many colliders worldwide trying to measure this low energy channel. So that's why all the green colored points you see, they came from different colliders, low energy colliders, such as the CMB or SND from Novosibirsk, or CLOI in Italy, Frascati, or Babar, or BESS. All these can provide the measurement, and there are many different results up to 2023. That was the latest one, CMB3. In the CMB, they updated detectors. So CMB3 is actually very, let's say, completely new from the CMB2. But I think this will still need to explain why CMB2 is very different from CMB3. But anyway, this was has always been the recipe for theorists to use this approach to calculate in the theory. And then recently, I mean, the recent years, the latest approach emerges. These, I mean, thanks to, I would say, mostly very high performance of the let's say computing resources, the also the advance on the computing techniques, the latest approach has reached the comparable precision. Since 2021, this BMW result. And since then, have continued to improve the precision. And since we do find the difference between these two approaches, now they are also trying to check in the different lattice scale windows. Because in the lattice calculation, they do separate the short distance, immediate distance, or the long distance in the lattice grid. This nuclear window to calculate different contributions. So what theorists are doing now is to trying to separate these different windows, and for each window they can compare some intermediate step to the data-driven approach. For example, here is the description of the CMB3 results in a particular raw mass region, which you see is very different from all the others. So the community is trying to understand what's going on here. Probably it's related to the Monte Carlo generators, and there's going to be new input from Babar or Chloe or the other colleagues also. So, but still, the data-driven approach needs a clarification. And on the other hand, the lattice approach is progressing and could possibly take this hadronic uncertainty down to the 0.1%, which corresponding to a similar precision for the G minus 2 in the standard model in a comparable precision to experiment. Because you see, if now the theory prediction is still slightly this one or this one, they are still larger than the experimental average. But in the next few years, when the lattice continue to improve the precision, it could be down to the similar level to experiment. And that would trigger for the need for the next generation measurements. So this is the current picture. So when theory is advancing, And now there's, as of now, there's no experiment approved today that aims to surpass the Fermilab record precision. So I think it's a time now for us to start thinking about the next generation G-3 experiment ideas. So in the next few slides, I will try to talk about these ideas. But first of all, we start from some lessons learned from Fermilab. So how Fermilab did the measurement and what's the limitations from the Fermilab. So I'm not going to cover all the detailed aspects from Fermilab experiment. There are many, but I'll only cherry-picking a few points that I feel important for the discussion of the next generation experimental ideas. So the basic principle from Fermilab measurement is simple. If we put the muon in a magnetic field, we know this spin precession, frequency omega s, and if it rotates in orbit, it also has a cyclotron frequency omega c. In terms of relativity, we do need this gamma factor in omega s and omega c. So you see these two frequencies. Basically, you see that the spin rotates, so omega s, slightly ahead of the momentum as we are orbiting. Actually, I still remember that Chris asked me back to new factor workshop last year why we can't directly use mu star to measure G-2. You see, if we do mu star, that's directly only omega s, there's no omega c. So only omega s means it's going to be a G factor, not a G-2. So the mu star frequency is G, not G, omega s. So it's related to G, not G-2. So this is going to be less precise. It's a pure Lamo precession frequency. And here, what Fermilab did is basically factor out this G, sorry, factor out two from the G to create G-2. And that to do that, we need to manually create an orbit. So omega c. And only if we subtract omega c, this frequency from omega s, we can create the frequency that is related directly to a mu, so G-2. So that's why we need the frequency differences rather than pure omega s. So that's why we need to put the mu, not let's say in the lab frame, but we need to let the muon rotate to create omega c manually. And then we can relate the difference of the frequency to a muon. And also, this would be impossible if the muon had no these intrinsic properties. So, this is also critical because the muons, we know they are polarized. So we know the direction of the spin when the muon enters the ring. That's also important. Otherwise, we don't know. It's impossible for us to know the difference between the two vectors. We need to know its direction. And also, the decay of the muon is self-analyzing to its spin direction. So the electrons from the muon decays prefers to emit in its spin direction. So that by detecting electrons, we are able to know the spin direction. These are also important factors that makes this G-2 measurement possible. So this is a very basic recipe. So basically, if we measure omega A, the frequency, and the B field, the external B field that we put in the lab, then we can extract the G-2. That's it. So for omega A, we detect the electrons from the muon decay. And by fitting this wiggle plot, we can get the frequency omega A. And to measure B field, we need a very precise technique such as NMR. So basically, we kind of put the proton in the water and measure its spin, omega p. So basically, the magnetic field, to measure the magnetic field, we also need to relate this field to another frequency, which is the proton precession frequency, omega p. So eventually, to extract the G minus 2, we need two frequencies. One is omega a, the other is omega p, so that we can extract a. This is the basic principle. Of course, in the real world, things are slightly complicated because all the previous formula assumes that the mirror motion is in the plane. But we know in the real world, the motion is never be perfect. It's nearly final, and the momentum is nearly ideal one. So this brings additional corrections. This is a full formula, and we need to remove these terms and these terms that we do not want and leave only the a mu, so G minus 3 here. To do that, so the momentum needs to be in the plane. So the vector, beta vector, should be perpendicular to the B field. And also be that the other important one is we do have electric field from electric quadruples. So this beta cross E is very problematic. But we do find that if we choose a certain gamma factor, this can be cancelled. So we roughly know the a mu, right? And we can calculate corresponding gamma, which is about 3 GeV over C for the mu. This has been called magic gamma, and this technique has been used since CERN experiment back to 1970. So this has been in some ways, this has been lucky because the magic gamma for mu is exactly around 3 GeV over C, which is feasible for most of the mu facilities, high-energy mu facilities. Otherwise, it is 30 GeV or even higher. It's that impossible for us to do this measurement because this is going to be a dominant source and completely destroy the a mu beta. Okay, so because of this, well, I mean, ideally, if mu, for example, is exactly 3.9094 GeV, this term would be very precisely cancelled. But we know in the real world, mu has more than spread, right? Let's say 2% or 10%. So, can not all mu's are perfectly sitting in this energy. So there's going to be some kind of correction from this term. And also, if mu has slight pitch angle, so if this angle, the momentum is not exactly perpendicular to the field, this also causes the mu's to wobble in the vertical direction. So this has been taken into account in record corrections from Beam Dynamics. So CE is the Eigil correction, CP is the pitch correction, and there are other field corrections, such as the time-dependent one. For the B field, we also need some correction from the magnetic field transfer. For example, Kicker introduced additional magnet that disturbs the main field and also electric quadruples. So the entire analysis in the FermLab has been grouped into several aspects, such as the omega A and omega P and beam dynamics. Each needs a lot of work. So it took, really a few many years for us to reach the final precision. And also, you see there's external input from these constants, such as the mu mass, but they have been measured very precisely to, let's say, 20 dB or something. So we don't need to worry about them for now, but we're going to explain a little bit later for the next generation. So that's all I want to say about FermLab experiment for now. This is the statistics. You see, we start data taking and publicate the data in the 3 time period. And because the precision of the omega A is proportional to 1 over square root of a, so you see, that's why we need almost 20 times of the Brookhaven statistics to reach only, let's say, 4 times more precise than the Brookhaven results because of this urban city in the sphere. And in the systematic wise, you see this is the final uncertainty table. The point here I just want to say is you see most of these systematic sources, they are quite evenly distributed at the final Fermat check. So this means there's not, let's say, very dominant source we can deal with to make a big improvement. And that also means further improvement based on the Fermat measurement will require to reduce the systematics in any category, which is difficult. But we do can think about some directions. For example, this 27 dB being a beam dynamic section of electric field, and also the BQ here, the transient SQ, these are all due to the existence of electric field. So that's one way that if we can migrate or mitigate the effect from the E field, we can probably try to reduce more than one uncertain sources from this table. So starting from here, let's talk about some possibilities. How might we do better given, let's say, the current Fermat setups? So this is kind of the precision formula. So the omega relative precision of the omega is proportional to one over least factors, including the gamma, so the energy of the muon, B field, the polarization of the muon, and the number of muons. First one is, let's say, if there's a possibility we can have more muons. So, but keep in mind, this n is inside the square root, so the increase would be not as efficient as others. But let's say, you see, one point is that currently Fermat only uses 2% of all incoming muons that the Fermat accelerator provides us because of the very wide range of the muon momentum for the incoming muons. And because of this matched momentum condition, we need only the muons at 3.094 GeV. So the acceptance is really limited. You see, all these muons from Fermat, we only store very small part into our experimental region. So let's say if for by any chance we can have a better muon beam with a mono energy at 3 GeV or the other energies we want, for example, the low emitters muon beam, this would release this acceptance and increase the total number of muons by a lot. And also, if we can do, for example, a better quality of the muon beam, that also helps to get smaller some systematics from the beam dynamics. Another point is if you look at the current boundary structure from the Fermat accelerator, I mean, this is mostly inherited from the proton structure. So we have two consecutive group of bunches, and each has, well, let's say in total, 11 hertz operation with 1 microsecond ticking. This is good, actually, even better than Brookhaven. But let's imagine the ideal case. What would be the ideal case? So we don't want many muons comes at the same time. It's better to have those muons spread uniformly into each small bunches. And for each bunch, we have enough time to finish the measurement before muon decays. So we inject a group of muons, measure its oscillation until muon decays after 70 microseconds. That's a lifetime. Then another bunch comes in. That's better because then we can do a better pi-up fractions because if now there's more muons come at the same time, this causes a problem for the detector pi-up, right? If those meals can be even more uniformly distributed in small batches, that also helps. Although this would be a very limited room for the improvement because this is most of the acceleratable icing. Yeah, other factors we can also think about. One is a higher gamma factor. You see, this could be really useful, but again, this is limited now due to the magic momentum condition. We have to choose neural at 3G. But let's say, just in case, if we can go away from the magic momentum, go to even higher gamma, this would also help to increase the precision, right? And the B-field. This would lead to a compact solenoid. Now, FermLab has 1.5 Tesla with a big ring of 40 meter diameter. Let's say if we do a drastic improvement, that's a factor of 10, that would be 15 Tesla. I know it's very challenging or even impossible, but that could mean a very small diameter of the neuron orbit with only 1.4 meters, even if we still go to the magic momentum. But in this case, there are many challenges. One of them is the boundary weight. So, as I mentioned, for each of the bunch of injecting into the storage ring, we need these storage finish. So the cyclotron period should be larger than the bunch weight. So before the first muons finish the one loop, all the muons in this bunch should be fully injected into the storage ring. And we know the current limit from the accelerator is around the 100 nanoseconds, or maybe we can do a few tens nanoseconds. But let's say if the magnetic field is increased by a factor of 10, that could mean 10 nanoseconds, or in this case, 15 nanoseconds, the cyclotron period. That makes this injection impossible. If we cannot fully inject all the muons before the first muon finish its first cyclotron time, that would be a disaster. So the ring is going to be full of the muons, and we don't know which spin direction at that location the muon is going to give us. So that's another problem technically. So all these factors we need to think about, but we do find there's a way try to increase the statistics. So a short summary of what we have discussed now. I would say it all comes down to this magic momentum constraint. I mean, there's no doubt it used to be a miracle since CERN experiments in the 1970s and greatly helped increase the precision. But now this magic momentum seems to be becoming a limiting factor for boosting muon numbers and operating higher energy. And even for higher B field, because if the high energy is needed, then to keep a reasonable cyclotron period, it will have to increase a higher to the muon to high energy to accommodate a higher B field, right? So all these factors are actually related to this magic momentum constraint in the principle we just talked about. Okay, so this is the this was the statistical wise some improvement we can see of, and there are systematic wise we can try to improve. This mostly, I mean, some of these has been implemented actually in the FermLab experiment, because you might know that FermLab actually used the same magnet ring from the Brooke paper 20 years ago. Based on this same ring, we do have implemented a lot of improvement in the detectors, in the field calibrations, etc. So these are just a few examples. Probably I should say also mention that the point is, we measure the decay positrons for omega A. So in the denominator, the omega A wise, this is the more statistical wise way to increase the number of muons, therefore number of decay electrons. But for the magnetic field measurement, this is more systematic improvement thing. We don't need to accumulate more statistics but we need higher techniques in enough probe or the other field calibration techniques help us to measure the B field more precisely. So many of these are related to the field measurement. And there has been a review article actually right before Christmas by David Herzog. He was a very cool person from, I mean, he's from University of Washington. He really a cool person for lab team. So he, in this article, he summarized the few important or possible improvements that could help the Fermilab setup go beyond the current 124 dB. In his context, he mostly discussed about the systematics improvement, the detectors in the field calibration settings. So if you're interested, I would recommend to have a look at this article for more information for the systematics. Finally, another limitation that they say. Not of great importance, but still, we should be aware of that Fermilab only measures positive fields to a very high precision. But back to 20 years ago, Brookhaven actually measured both positive and negative muons. It was a really shame that Fermilab has no time to measure the negative muons. We do try to get more beam time, but Fermilab said no, we need to switch to mu to e. So the G minus 2 experiment has been wired now right now. But you see that by comparing positive and negative muons, we gain some additional physics grip, especially in the CPT test. There's a charge parity time violation with possibly related to new physics. Brookhaven at that time used both positive and negative G minus 2 data. They can constrain a lot of parameters in the new physics models, such as the standard model extension. And actually, all these numbers are currently still limited by the Brookhaven G minus 2, many of them, because of the fact that the Fermilab is not able to provide the negative muon measurement. Maybe also, I mean, many of you know that the intensity of the negative muon is smaller than the positive muon. So that's most important reason that Fermilab prioritized the positive muon. That's the reason down to the generation level. But it was really a shame that it provides only positive muon essentially. And another new G minus 2 experiment you might have heard of is an idea in Japan. So this is completely different method. It's still under construction. It's not taking data yet. This experiment uses many new technologies, such as the muon cooling, to create high quality muon beams before the muon gets injected into the storage, into a 3D spiral web. So that's because of a very compact radius. They have to a 3D spiral web. Otherwise, the change would be more drastic. So by muon cooling, the low emittance beam can be created so that because this muon beam is very high quality, so there's no need for the electric field to help to focus the beam. In Fermilab, this is necessary because without E field, there's no vertical focusing. So muon beam just dispersed, gone before we can recruit and detect the dimension. But in this case, it's possible. So that you see, if there's no field, no electric field in the storage, there's no need to keep this matched momentum constraint. That's one, idea. So they make it possible. So in principle, this experiment can measure muon at any momentum we like. However, after cooling, you see the energy of the muon is very low, 25 millielectron volt. So we need to put additional effort to re-accelerate muons. And that costs a lot. That's why, in JPARC, they can only do this re-acceleration to 200 MB, so it is still far from 3G, right? Phone app is 3G. So unfortunately, it only accelerates, up to a few hundred MB. So this is not good. If you remember, we see this precision is proportion to 1 over gamma. So a higher gamma, the better precision. But now this is only 200 MB. So that's why actually it caused the J-POD experiment to. It needs to take a lot of more muons to reach even the similar precision to the Brickheimer level. You see, the precision for the phase one of the J-POD is only 0.46 ppm. And remember, if the FermLab is 0.12 ppm, so a factor of four. And another point is, in this case, the cooling method is done by ionization of the muon. So the positive muons need to be injected into the material to form a mu plus E minus atom. And this atom to be further ionized by the laser. So a laser helps to kick out the electron to make the muon in a room temperature. And we instantly realized that the negative muons cannot be cooled using this technique. Actually, this could be kind of interest for muon collider, but only part of the muon collider for the positive muon acceleration, not negative muons. So still, this is the kind of the limitation for the J-POD experiment. Yes, I guess it's not good for me to say something very pessimistic for this because I have my PhD for this experiment. But I have to say, in terms of next generation consideration, this 200 MeV is not sufficient to reach a very good statistics. So this really makes a high precision measurement difficult. Unless, let's say we can further using advanced techniques to accelerate muons to even higher energy beyond 3 dB. Then that could be, considered, I would say, as be a next generation experiment. But on the other hand, it's apparently a very good platform for technology development because in this experiment there are a lot of new technologies, cooling, acceleration, 3D spiral injection. All these are going to be the first time to implement in the real experiments. And probably this is another lesson, because J-POD experiment was initiated in 2012 or 2013. So back to 10 years ago, that precision of 0.46 ppm may be still, a good precision target. But now after FermLab concludes its final precision, then, this J-POD target become a bit outdated because if only we achieve 0.46 ppm, that's not very helpful to clarify the current theory and experimental mass. So to do kind of next generation experiment, we really need to plan ahead. That's why I sort of prefer to go even higher energy instead of staying lower. Using, let's say, low energy muon sources, because here J-POD uses the surface muon beam, which starts from low energy. But if we directly start from higher energy, a few GeV muons, that could be even better. Okay, so these are kind of, let's say, lessons learned from FermLab, also from J-POD so far. So, what we want to do for the next generation muon optimizer too. First, the precision should match or at least match or surpass the FermLab precision 0.1 ppm. And we also prefer a new approach as an independent cross-check because FermLab, the FermLab approach has hit the limits, apparently, there's no doubt. Also, if you think again for the current landscape, there's only one experimental measurement. That's it. And in many senses, not very satisfactory. For example, in the LHC, we have ATLAS and CMS provide cross-checks each other, and not always the results from CMS and ATLAS would be very consistent. So this is important. I mean, it's not naive thing. We need to cross-check from another independent approach. I mean, I was involved. I was personally also in the startup collaboration, but I mean, it's fair to say there could be kind of some intrinsic bias in the startup approach from Brookhaven to startup that this common bias could make the current solely the experimental result bias. So we do need a cross-check at a very high precision. And if feasible, we prefer negative mu's for additional physics risk. So these are some ideas. So let's assume, yes. So the point here is that mainly we need to think about relaxing this matched moment constraint, go to high energy. It really helps a lot in the statistical wise and also the systematic wise. And that could naturally point us to a novel focusing scheme. Of course, we need sufficient statistics such as a high intensity GEV scale, source. I guess due to limited time, I'll just very briefly flash a few concepts here. I do prepare the many slides, but I guess I'll just flash them out here. One is the hybrid weak focusing. So in the first lab, it is only electric quadruple focusing. But if we extend this focusing, adding additional magnetic field quadruples, then this could be compensate for the higher order effect. So they cancel each other. This has been also proposed by one or actually two of our FermLab colleagues in 2022 to trying to use as upgrade version of the FermLab Challenge 2. But at this version, we don't need to keep the magic momentum. So it can be in principle for a higher gamma factor to increase the statistical precision. They do have some studies in the optimizing E field and B field index to find out the best concept. But now, still at this stage, this is idea and nuance. We need to perform the study for this scheme. We need, for example, plotting rear beam profiles, etc. The other one is so-called proton beam chromagnetometer. So in this case, you see we do not use the fluorine magnet, but so we can try to use a separate segmented magnet. And the focusing scheme would be from the edge focusing. So the edge field from the magnet can also help to focus the beam vertically. It was still crazy, we were talking about this edge focusing. So I was firstly asking questions back to you back to the earlier months ago. So that was the time. So the edge focusing structure was firstly proposed by a British scientist, Francis Farley, who was also a senior member, the Jim Wang Institute from Brookhaven. He passed away, I think, in 2018 or 2019. But he was the one who initially proposed this, but it has never been, experimentally realized. And the other challenge for this is the precise calibration of edge field from the magnet, so that he proposed that you use the polarized proton to calibrate the field. So if the proton beam can go well a few loops here, that could directly, use the same precession of the proton to adding a polarimeter to measure to calibrate the B field. That could be even precise, even more precise for the B field measurement. I guess I'll skip all of these discussions, but so I was trying to summarize all these points, and we actually also try to propose this kind of next generation miniaturized measurement. We are aiming for kind of three times improvement, a factor of three improvement compared to the FermLab. I think, I mean, we think this is feasible. So I was going to introduce a bit more in another new reconstructed facility in China, which is a heavy iron oxide facility, which could potentially provide a comparable mill intensity to the furnace. I guess I'll skip some of this, but this is just to say we do try some studies on the mill being simulations using this facility. It's still under commissioning, so it was finished construction and start the first beam commission last October, and the first mill beam is expected later this year actually. So starting from there, we can also try to compare the precision requirements, and you see that actually the negative mills in this facility is actually comparable to the positive mills, or even higher under certain circumstances, because this is a heavy iron acceleration, so not only proton but also other heavy ions, so it can create a very different mill energy spectrum. With even upgrade, it can provide even higher proton energy, up to 25 GeV in the next 10 or 20 years. So with this higher energy proton, the mill energy could be even higher, up to, let's say, 20 GeV. So that's really a good story, because currently it's still 1 to 5 GeVs, around the 3 GeV, so a magic bump. But later on, it could be up to higher energy and higher bump. So this could be, you know, really a potential to improve the statistical precision a lot. So we have tried to compare the mill beam intensity and possible precisions. And with very high mill beam, let's say 15 GeV, eventually the statistical sensitivity won't be a problem at all. So this can be purely systematically limited. And if we can really realize this version, it can, you know, help to improve the tremendous precision really a lot. So, I'll skip some of these questions, but yeah, let's actually say our final precision. We aim at 3 times higher than the for that precision. Finally, some physics technical synergies. I put some of these because the proposal we are trying to put here is segmented magnet. It actually has many synergies. For example, polarized proton is also necessary for the EIC development. And I also learned that, for example, one of the neutrino factory idea concept, Neostorm, also uses probably several things, similar things, because, you know, if we store the mill beam in this ring and just stretch to make this linear part longer, then the muon decays and naturally provide us some neutrino source. But of course, the intensity will be another factor we need to consider. I would say this could be kind of some interesting synergies if we proceed with the development of exciting. Basically, I mean, and I guess the final point is, I guess, you know, this idea, this design is not necessarily limited to a facility, for example, health. For example, if CERN is interested in this idea, I mean, we know that CERN can also provide up to 100 GeV mills. Although it's now centered at 150 GeV, which is really high, but if it can come down to a few tens GeV, then maybe we can also consider the next generation GeMiNs to add to CERN or even FermNap or BlueTable. You know, this is adaptable to facilities worldwide, I would say. But anyway, I hope this could trigger some kind of you know, new ideas or common development. Okay, finally, this is a summary. This GeMiNs puzzle has been over, you know, past 60 years to increase or trigger both experiment and theory activities, and will continue to do so. And I believe that, I mean, there's no doubt the current puzzle in theory will eventually be clarified and resolved. Then the time will come for the next generation Mutant Humanities. And you see, Fermilab initiated a proposal in 28 or sorry, 2008 or 2009. So it took more than 10 years up to now to finish Fermilab experiment. JPOC started from 2012 or 2013, and now it's still under construction. So this is really a long-term effort for experiment from its initialization to be completed. So this talk, I mean, in this talk, I've tried to kind of push forward with these new proposed ideas, especially featuring some novel focusing schemes, and I've explained why I'm trying to do this. And we believe the target of a factor of three more precise than Fermilab is feasible. Okay, so I struggled last night to find trying to find some kind of impressive photo plot, but I didn't succeed. So this is a usual summary plot of everything we have so far. In the next few years, we will certainly see improvement of the theory, and hopefully in the next 10 or 20 years we can see also new experiments. So there's a quote from Fred Jagan I liked very much. Go to look the more this. Thank you.
Thank you very much for such a very nice
Yeah, sorry to our time.
Yeah, no problem. So yeah, we have time for some questions. Yeah, start with if you go to the previous slide. Just in the summary. So, I mean, I've heard a lot of people from latest consider themselves to be experimentalists. What are you considering them in the theory block or the experimental block?
I would not say they are experimentalists, I guess. Yeah, they are serious. I mean, the experiment is really a lot. We have, let's say, 200 collaborators in our lab, and each we work with a lot of internal activities. A lot is, I mean, of course, they are trying to incorporate some experiment things, but I will say they are doing maybe experiments. Of course, I mean, nowadays everyone is very high powerful computing resources, but still, you need some, thoughts or input from physics in the theory. Yeah. It's not trivial to make a high precision computation. And it's very different from the experiment tactics.
Thank you.
You mentioned the higher upgrade proposal. Is that funded or is that planned? What's the level?
I don't think it's funded. I guess the review committee is going to see the results from phase one before they can give them full fund. The good thing, I guess, is they have prepared technically the space for upgrade. So the upgrade is going to be in the same ring. So currently, when I visit the tunnel there, they have a very big tunnel. So currently, they only use half of the tunnel to have for the phase one, this single ring here and single ring there. But for upgrade, they just need to put another ring together. So the tunnel is there's enough space in the tunnel. That's good. So it's going to be the additional accessory components for phase one, for phase two.
I had many questions, but during the talk, you answered many of them. So I think it's a very nice talk and reference to the slides. So maybe I can ask, is it possible that the muon, the measurement of G minus to, for the muon to exceed the measurement for the electron, which is currently, as you said, the best measured physics
quantum? I would say it's very difficult, or in other way, let's say the electron you might do is really measured very precisely. I guess I don't have the slides, but the techniques are very different. So the electron G minus 2 has been actually using completely different approach called the Henning trap. So they basically store a single electron. So an electron doesn't decay. So you can take your time to do the measurement. But muon in this case, you know, decays. And to measure the muon trends, to we need to, you know, manually create or consider all the wind dynamics. That's never been a problem for the electron trends. So we can do really good if I remember correctly, I think the frequency they measure is still the frequency measure, electron trends. And because of this single particle panning trap, you can use a lot of techniques to improve the precision. For example, laser, that's not possible for the muon trends. So, personally, I would still say electron G minus 2 can be more precise. But I mean, we still have 14,000 up there. So.
And is there an attempt to improve that measurement for E minus?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I guess the device is still there. And I mean, the publication was only a few years ago. I should have remembered, but I think there's kind of a discrepancy from different sources or approach for the electron G minus 2 or something related to the fine structure constant. Yeah, I'll have to double check after, but I think there's kind of a puzzle they have to that needs to be resolved before they advance another electron G minus 2 measure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's still also. I say also is a kind of a puzzle there.
That's very interesting. Yes. I don't see questions and I don't see on Zoom. So we close the meeting and we will have lunch. Thank you very much, everyone.
Okay.